Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazilahiki. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a story on housing rights and speak with representatives from Poor People's Army about the recent lawsuit against HUD. Then we hear from singer Pearly Rousseau, who talks about how music can connect the public with the issues surrounding Norlite. Later on, the Sanctuary for Independent Media is hiring a development director. We speak with Melissa Bromley, who has had the position for the last 5 years, to learn more. After that, we have a final segment in the discussion from the 4th of July to Juneteenth, what they mean to Black people. Finally, we have an interview with Albany Center Gallery director Tony Iadicio, but first, here are the headlines. Troy resident Tom Mooney, age 35, was selected to compete in the powerlifting event at the Special Olympics USA Games at Disney World in Orlando next summer. State Attorney General Letitia James announced Thursday that her office had reached a $1.1 billion settlement with three of the nation's largest drug distributors accused of helping to fuel the opioid epidemic. New York and local municipalities that sign off on the agreement should begin to see money from the settlement in just 2 months. Funds will be doled out over the course of 17 years and must be spent on addiction prevention, treatment, and recovery services. We're now joined by Eileen Javier. The Times Union reports that Troy plans to apply for a state grant up to $400,000 to repair the 130-year-old Rensselaer County Soldiers and Sailors Monument in downtown. After years of slow deterioration, the city failed several years ago to secure a similar grant to address the damage. The Albany Common Council voted 9-2 Monday night to approve a measure that creates the state's first good cause eviction law. The Times Union reports that the law entitles tenants to a renewed lease, protection against large rent increases when renewing their leases, and eviction unless landlords can meet one of the 10 possible conditions. Landlords are expected to challenge the law in court. There is similar legislation pending in the state legislature. The bill would end no-fault evictions and require landlords to justify rent increase above 1.5% of the consumer price index.
And the police are no longer seizing marijuana, making arrests, or issuing tickets for low-level possession for travelers passing through Albany International and other airports across the state.
Saratoga Springs native Alexis Brown and her boyfriend Marcus Filian, both 21, were headed back to Brown's mom's house after Black Lives Matter protest Wednesday in Saratoga Springs, when police followed them and pulled them over, saying that they were investigating possible weapons at the peaceful protest. Brown and other activists said that they think the police are attempting to stir up fear that protests were violent by suggesting they were investigating the threat of weapons at protests. That's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM in Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art, science, and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
The Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign has filed suit against HUD to have housing declared a human right and to allow families to live in vacant homes, Sherry Honkala and Chamaco Noble of the Poor People's Army discussed the case with Mark Donley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
So recently, the Philadelphia-based Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, also with the Poor People's Army, filed a lawsuit to basically declare housing a human right. It was particularly, we'll go more into it, about individuals living in housing, abandoned somewhat in the city of Philadelphia, have been reclaimed, and they want to make sure they're not evicted. But to actually explain what the lawsuit does and the importance of it, we're joined by Sherry Honkala of the Poor People's Army and Chamaco Noble, a hip-hop artist and member of the Poor People's Army as well. So can you give us a brief explanation? You know, what was the lawsuit and why is it so important?
Well, it's incredibly important because 10 million people couldn't afford to pay rent in January. So we know that there's no place for those families to go across the entire country. And so we want to keep the families that are in poor houses in those places. So that's why we filed the lawsuit.
And yeah, what? If I may, you know,
sure.
I also want to add, you know, this particular administration, the Biden administration, has overtly declared that housing is a human right. You know, we're just challenging them to, you know, step up to their declaration, to codify in law, you know, what's stated in politics. You know, we do know that they have taken some steps openly to embrace, quote unquote, universal, stable and affordable housing. We argue that that housing is already available.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in your lawsuit in the city of Philadelphia, there's actually about 10 vacant houses for every homeless person. Why does that type of situation exist?
Well, that's a good question.
That's the question.
Yes, there's we had cartographers that mapped out not only Philadelphia, but every other city across the country. And in Philadelphia, I was thinking that there was maybe two or three properties for every homeless family, but there's actually 10 properties. So what we could do is we could actually decide to end homelessness. We don't have to do the tiny houses thing. We don't have to do the build bigger and better encampments. We can just, you know, move families into properties and if they need other kinds of wraparound services, we can do that while they're living in those properties.
So just following, you know, the campaign a bit on Facebook and other social media. So this is something you guys already been doing. You're already been trying to help people, you know, move into these vacant homes.
Yes, we've been doing we've been doing this for the last 30 years, teaching people how to take over abandoned houses and move them in. And we've been doing it across the country. Right now in Philadelphia, we're in over properties right now that are abandoned.
So since this is something, you know, at least the concept of housing as a human right is something that the, you know, Biden administration apparently has embraced. Did they call you up and thank you for filing this lawsuit and ask how can we settle this to your satisfaction?
I haven't received any calls. Sherry, have you gotten an email to that effect?
No, actually, quite the opposite. The day that the Biden administration said that there was going to be a moratorium extension getting kicked out of their homes is the same day that Ms. Fudge from the HUD administration filed papers against the homeless families in the takeover houses.
Which is ironic, considering that I believe today they're on a national call for, you know, as we mentioned before, universal, stable and affordable housing. So, you know, again, they definitely play the PR game about, you know, getting people properly housed and the abundant amount of housing that's available. But yeah, we definitely haven't received that note from them.
So Shimako, you know, you mentioned your hip hop artists. Has the hip hop community, you know, sort of embraced this campaign and help publicizing it?
Sections of it. You know, I think it's something that we're still working on, connecting to various parts of the community. It's something that we're actively doing now. But it's also, it's not a new issue for a lot of sections of the community. I don't know if you want to, you know, take the time to look this up, if it'll be relevant ever, but there's an artist by the name of Will C out in Detroit, you know, a city that's been through a lot of economic changes over the last 50 to 60 years. And he did a song, great song called Take the House Back. That was very popular in its space. We'd like to see more folks in the hip hop community and other sort of subculture communities embrace this movement, but it is something we're still working on.
Now, normally when one files lawsuits against the federal government to have them recognize rights, it's usually not a easy win. How are you expecting this lawsuit to proceed?
Well, we're excited because this is the first time that we've had a big time civil rights attorney that's offices are in Center City here in Philadelphia take us seriously. And so he is making five different arguments. One is religious, around religious freedom. Another is around fair housing. He's going to have the HUD administration have to argue how if we hadn't moved these families into these abandoned takeover houses, what other choices would they have had? Because what's happening here in Kensington, which is happening all across the country, is they're building luxury units at rates. And, you know, once in a while, you know, Habitat for Humanity will build, you know, two or three properties. But our argument is that we can, you know, repair any of these houses and build as many units of affordable housing, if not more than luxury units.
Now, this lawsuit has been filed in Philadelphia, but you're trying to get this, I guess, to apply, you know, nationwide by making, you know, housing a human right that I guess HUD has to actually take some responsibility for. What can people in other parts of the country do at this point to help support this litigation and the general, you know, efforts of the Poor People's Army?
Well, I'm just going to jump in and say one more thing before Shimako chimes in, but other attorneys, like we're talking to an attorney right now in Chicago. We have a member that's on the National Lawyer Guild. They are looking at writing briefs and adding them onto this case to make it more national in scope, including the resources here in Philadelphia, which is the largest disabled organization that has a huge waiting list for people that have disabilities that have nowhere to live as well. So that's definitely one thing that can be done is, you know, if you're out there, you don't know how you're going to house yourself or your family or your friends, link up with a progressive attorney, send them our way.
And Shimako will give you the closing words.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's just a few things that folks can do. Obviously, you know, a situation like this, an organization like this, we're always out here doing the work. And of course, the work needs to be funded. So if folks want to donate, they can go to poorpeoplesarmy.com. You know, $5, $10, $20 makes a huge difference. We also have a petition that's currently growing. Right now, we're at 2,000 signatures. Our goal is at 5,000. They can find that petition at actionnetwork.org. Keep their ears to the ground. If folks know of other alternative media, or local college, independent, public radio that we can connect with, by all means, connect us with it. And otherwise, just, you know, stay informed and engaged. Continue fighting the good fight.
So we want to thank Sherry Hankla and Shimako Noble from the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign / Poor People's Army. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To repeat the link from Shimako Noble, that was poorpeoplesarmy.com for more information on the right to live in vacant houses and the larger housing rights.
Joe Riffy talks with Pearlie Rousseau, a local singer who performs under the group name of Sonny and Pearlie. She talks about how music can connect the public with the issues surrounding Norlight and how the DEC has not been doing enough to safeguard the public.
Where do you live?
In Cohoes, New York.
How long have you lived in this community for?
Going on 26 years.
What is your profession?
I am a vocalist, a full-time musician, vocalist, and my husband as well.
Great. And when did you decide you wanted to be a vocalist? Like, how did that all start?
Oh my gosh, gee. When did I decide? Probably in my 20s when I started getting serious about it and studying and taking lessons, yeah.
Do you have any inspirations that kind of made you be a singer? Or did you kind of just go off of your own will?
Well, I think it was due probably to the music that I was exposed to as a child, you know, inspired by people like Ella Fitzgerald and people
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, no, those are really great people to be inspired by. How have you seen your profession impact the communities that you sing in, that you perform in? You know, what do people say to you after they see a show?
Well, most people are very grateful and they feel that they've been moved in some way and that their mood has improved and they're happier, you know, than when they first came in at the beginning of the show. And we've served the Capital District for 36 years, my husband and I. He also books entertainment. So he's booked bands and he's played for many governmental events, for the mayor, for the governor many times, many governors. Three, I think. Three or four, actually. And also for, he does a lot of government events in general, yeah, and he still books them. So, yeah, we've done a lot, and we also travel a bit. So when we're on the road, we go all the way down the East Coast to Florida, and I think the communities there are very impacted. We play primarily in libraries down there.
That's awesome and really, you know, inspirational for the people that are listening to your shows and obviously to the people who know about what you do. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your awesome contributions. So my next question is going to be, how did you find out about Norlight?
I think that I was either sent an email or I saw an article either on perhaps the city's Facebook page. I'm not exactly sure. It was one of those two things.
Sure. Was that rather recently or was that within like the last 5-4 years or so?
Oh, no, that was 2020, I believe.
Okay.
2020, sorry.
So if you had to think about it just real quickly, you know, how could we connect music with the struggle of, you know, environmental discrimination or just with Norlight? How can you see, you know, your obvious tools to make the situation better for those who live in the community or those who might just want to hear something inspirational?
I'm not sure. The only thing I can think of is to raise funds for the fight against Norlight.
Sure.
By playing music and selling tickets or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I think that's awesome. And, you know, some of the things I can think about too is like if people want like tips on how to be a successful performer,
mm-hmm.
people who are maybe growing up in Saratoga sites, you know, that's only 100 feet away from Norlight,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They might be really interested in reaching out or maybe even speaking with the Cohoes chorus, you know, doing a performance there or even just helping out what they can do, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
just some ideas off the head.
I had never thought about that. Mm-hmm.
Recently, an article just came out in the Times Union describing potential toxic spray coming from the Norlight Hazardous Waste Incinerator being contaminated with PFAS. Obviously, PFAS and all that is very complicated science, but what are your initial reactions and thoughts to this article?
Well, I agree that PFAS and PFOS are both harmful chemicals, and it's been proven that they are. And so it's alarming that Norlite has been operating and burning this stuff for a very long time. Now, I realize we actually changed the law with the PFAS, and we're happy about that. But as I understand it, there are still some levels of PFAS in the water on the property that is very questionable. And also what's alarming is the amount of mercury that is being allowed to emit into the air, over 50 pounds of mercury. And as I understand it, it only takes about a tablespoon to contaminate an entire Adirondack Lake. So that's extremely alarming. And the dust has been a problem forever. And I don't know if it was the dust or what it was when I was there in December of 2020. But when I happened to drive into the area, the snow was a grayish black. So I don't know if that's the dust or the pollution coming from the stacks, from the incinerators or what exactly it is.
So regarding the black snow over there at Saratoga Sites and that pretty much surrounding area, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, well, that's normal.
Normal? Really?
But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, we live about, what, 3 miles maybe? 3-4 miles at the most from there. We've never had black snow up here on the hill or even gray snow. No, I don't think it's normal. And as a matter of fact, I even thought at first it was just from cars driving by, but it was impossible for it to be just that because the black grayish covering that I saw was all the way up against the building. And that's a good distance from the street. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's some of the things that I kind of see too. When I am in the area and talking with people.
Uh-huh.
So my next question is, do you feel that the DEC is doing a proper job at protecting the community of Cohoes?
I hate to say this, but it doesn't seem like it, no.
Do you care to say why you may have that inclination?
Well, I was on a Zoom call with the DEC, and it was just very obvious that it was, you know, just a lot of talk. And I have another word for that, but I won't use it.
Yeah. No, I can see that on those WebEx calls, there was a lot of frustration with how they are being held. A lot of frustration with basically some people were being muted as they were talking. So, like, if you were in an actual public forum, this stuff would not happen because you can't just mute somebody when they're talking. So do you feel that the mayor is doing enough to push the DEC to protect this community?
You know, I certainly believe that the mayor has every good intention for all of the citizens of Cohoes. And when I spoke with him last week, he did say that he had faith in the DEC, that they were doing a good job. So, you know, that's all I can really say on that. I personally don't think they are doing as much as they could because this type of complaint has been going on for so long, for so many years.
Yeah, I've personally seen documents at least dating back from 1990s about the same issues that we're talking about today. Do you believe Norlite cares about the public health of Cohoes?
No, I don't.
Do you care to elaborate just a little bit as to why?
Well, it's just obvious because they've had so many citations and they've just kept on doing what they're doing. Is citation the right word or what was the word we...
So the DEC has done a lot of violations.
Violations, yes, that they've had one violation after another. And they continued to do what they wanted to do until they were made to stop by the governor. And it almost seems like they just push it as far as they can until someone stops them.
If you can make a decision today about the future of Norlite. Would you keep the facility open or would you have it closed?
I'd have it closed.
And is this because of the reasons you just stated in the previous question?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you believe that people should be living 100 feet away from this type of facility, or even that Norlite should be located in a residential area?
Absolutely not. It was bad planning.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to speak with me. It was really valuable, the stuff that you've spoke about, and I really appreciate it giving me the time of day to interview with you today.
You're welcome.
Joe Ritchie brings us a weekly segment on Norlite, and in this segment, he spoke with Pearlie Rousseau, a singer living in Cohoes.
For those just tuning in, I am Eileen Javier.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. The Sanctuary for Independent Media is hiring a development director. Melissa Bromley has been the development director for the last 5 years and spoke with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Sina Bazila-Hickey, about this position, what attracted her to the sanctuary, and how the sanctuary's mission aligns with her own.
Speaking with me today is Melissa Bromley, development director at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Sina.
So what is a development director? Could you talk a little bit about the work that you do here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media?
Yeah. So development director is generally the title that's given to somebody at a nonprofit who's focused on fundraising. And I think it's like a sort of an intentional way of hiding the fact that you're focused on fundraising. So when you're introducing yourself to new people, they don't know that you're going to ask them for money eventually. But by now, since that has been the term for a while, people know.
How important is fundraising to a place like the Sanctuary for Independent Media?
I feel like that goes without saying, but obviously it's super important. I mean, none of this work could be possible without financial support to make it happen.
And a large part of that is also sanctuary sustainers. We currently have a sustainer campaign. Isn't that right?
That is very right. Yeah. And when we say sanctuary sustainer, we mean folks who are contributing monthly. The goal of the sustainer campaign is to sign up contributors of dollars. But I also wanted to say that you're a sanctuary sustainer if you're contributing your time and talents here, like all of the producers at the Hudson Mohawk Magazine as well.
So what brought you to this job? What brought you to the sanctuary and to Troy?
I'll have to shorten that story. But I had been living in Durham, North Carolina, and was intentionally making a move to this general geographic area to be closer to my family and the family of my partner. And with the transition north, I wanted to transition my work also. I had been working in tech, which was very fun and well-paying, but I, you know, sometimes would sit in a windowless room and talk about Twitter for an hour. And it just wasn't how I felt like I wanted to be spending my my like work and efforts and what I have into the world. So I thought about how I might want to be spending those efforts and what I had learned and where I could bring it. And nonprofit development, fundraising came up as something that could be a good fit for the skills I had. And so I moved to Troy without a job and started volunteering immediately at Unity House and also for a friend of mine who does advocacy for prisoner and parolee rights. And within a month or two, I saw this job pop up, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, which I had heard of but had never been to, was hiring for a development director. And I thought, well, this is the right job for me. I know that, but how do I let the sanctuary know that? So I was able to put together an application, and I was very lucky to have the development director at Unity House act as a reference for me. And I had been able to do some grant writing as a volunteer there. So I had, you know, a sample grant to send along with my application. And then it turned out that my friend Judith Brink, who I'd been volunteering for, helping out with her prisoner and parolee rights work, was like a former co-founder of the sanctuary. And I didn't know this at the time. I asked her to write me a reference, but she went beyond that. And she was emailing the folks here and calling them up and telling them what a mistake it would be if they didn't hire me. So I got lucky. And also, you know, it was at that time a job that was, it was paying $35,000, which is well below the average for a development director position. So they were probably going to have to either compromise on someone's experience like me or the time and effort that someone was going to put into the job. And I think it's worked out. I've been here now for just over 5 years. It's been an amazing experience for me. I've learned a tremendous amount, met so many amazing people, and really felt like the work I was doing every day was helping to make the world better in these really beautiful and creative and special ways. Super grateful.
What I find exciting getting to know you better through the time that I've been working here is you go beyond the sanctuary and you're really immersed in Troy. And so how does your work and your ethics, how do they mesh in and outside of the sanctuary?
Yeah, well, you know, the sanctuary's mission is to use art and action in support of social and environmental justice. And I think that it is authenticity that is important to the work here. But also, if you're asking people to be contributing their money or their time, you better be doing the same. And what's been really great about working at the sanctuary for me is that it has been a role that's allowed for me to be active in other ways. So helping with voter registration, we set up a voter registration booth in Freedom Square, and it became part of my job to do that. And it's great to work someplace where there's room for you to carry out your own vision of what you think might make a difference. You know, I had to skip work in 2019 to go protest in New York City to be a part of an action helping block the Brooklyn Bridge for Extinction Rebellion. I got arrested. That was the intention of the day. And I didn't have to lie to my employer. You know, it's like, great. They were excited to have me down there. And that was a couple years ago. I've been on calls related to the sanctuary and seen other people who I was arrested with in New York City who are, you know, I'm collaborating with through the sanctuary in other new ways that are also related to environmental justice. It's just a special thing to be able to live a life where the work that I'm getting paid to do is fully integrated with the work that I would be doing if I didn't have to get paid by anybody. And it supports the work here because the people I meet doing these other things are able to support the sanctuary in different ways.
I know that you'll be sticking around, but you are moving on out of this position of development director. So the position is open. For listeners who are interested in the job or passing it along, could you talk a little bit about what we're looking for? What would be helpful for a possible applicant to know about this position?
Probably the biggest skill that you need to have is writing, storytelling, whether it's grant writing or writing a really heartfelt thank you note, reporting or emails or appeals. Most of what I'm doing is writing. Beyond that, I think being open-hearted and really caring about the world.
At the Sanctuary for Independent Media, part of being the development director is understanding the different initiatives that make up this organization. So we have the Nature Lab and People's Health Sanctuary and Sanctuary Radio, The Garden. How do you explain these different initiatives to people who are trying to figure out what this organization is?
It's hard. To be honest, sometimes I pare it down. You know, I pick just the things that are relevant in a given conversation or to a particular funder. My personal view on how it all ties together is that this is a place that is very alive. It's a really special place. I mean, it's able to listen to the needs of the moment and the people around us and pair that with the talents and skills and offerings of our community. And that's something, you know, in my personal life, I love connecting people. And the fact that that is something that the sanctuary does as at the core is really meaningful to me. So, for example, you mentioned the People's Health Sanctuary, which is our newest initiative. You know, starting in 2018, when we were raising the funds to build the new Nature Lab Center, and put in a community science lab, which we just opened, we held community listening sessions. And what we were hearing was people were really excited and happy about the work we were doing around climate justice and thinking and addressing issues of soil and water and air health. But also that in our neighborhood, environmental justice means looking at trauma and issues of embedded poverty and physical health disparities. And that was what people wanted from us. And so at around the same moment, Dr. Xavier Coughlin started getting involved and brought in other folks who had been doing sort of grassroots health care. And out of that came what was originally called the Health Autonomy Clinic. And then through more listening, and actually through the Uptown Summer Program last year, went through a shift into the People's Health Sanctuary. Right now, we're working with young people, talking about issues of trauma and mental health. And it's just really inspiring to be able to work for an organization that can, you know, build, has infrastructure and programming to address the things that people are wanting from us.
What else should listeners know about the development director position?
Well, you should know that it's, you know, looking to be filled immediately, and that you can find the full job description on mediasanctuary.org. If you visit that page, you'll see a red bar that says we're hiring. Click that, and it'll give you more information about the role and information about how to apply.
We hope you'll help us spread the word and send people to that red bar on our website at mediasanctuary.org. And that interview was with the incredible Melissa Bromley, the current development director.
Next, we have our final segment from the roundtable discussion on from the 4th of July to Juneteenth, what do they mean to Black people? Roman Labor correspondent Willie Terry is joined by panelists David Walker, Leon Van Dyke, Carlo Dufler, and Angel Martinez.
There was at least about 10 union buses from New York that came. Workers, just plain humble people. They were not anybody that had, you know, some had conscience and some didn't have conscience. But the very aspects of when I saw 10 buses full of these people, it enlightened my faith. It enlightened my heart to know that they were fighting for just the right to live. We can't divorce that.
Okay, all right. It's about 6:20. We got a few more minutes. I want to close this out, but what I want us to do is I want, you know, any, you know, us to give any closing statements or summations or something that you didn't say. You can say it now. And I'm going to start with Leon.
I think that one of the main things that we have to realize that, one, as Black people have a certain percentage of the population, that we can't do it alone. But now we're in a position that Black, brown people are almost in the majority in this country. Still, Black and brown people, we can't do it alone. We must seek out allies, wherever they come from. I don't care where they come from. Whether they come from whites or they come from Mars. We
need allies.
The most likely place where we get the allies is from the working class. Because we are working class in this country.
That's correct. We ain't rich.
All right.
97% of Black people.
One of the things that threatens the far right and those people, corporate bankers, ruling class, is a coalition forming, which Jesse liked to call the Rainbow Coalition, what we call them, is an anathema to their gaining power. If we can be united, we can push an agenda that's benefit for us all. So I would say that it's important that we as black people, that we seek out allies. Our first allies is brown people. There's no question about that. But and those forces in the white community, for reasons of their own, whether it's environmental reason, they can get their agenda also without us. So we need them, they need us. And that's the difference, I think, between us winning and losing.
All right.
Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, go ahead, Dave.
You know, one of the things that I think there was clearly as the struggle advances, we're going to have to be cognizant of who our real allies are and whose position is similar to ours as we advance for freedom and justice and all those things. And I think it'll be a mistake without going into it deeply for black people not to understand that our interests, many of our interests, are tied to the Palestinians. And we just can't be all out for the things that are going on over there, and we should support their right to their land, which we've been talking about, and their language, and all those things that if we don't support them, we're going to be obliterated. So the Palestinian question is important to us. And I'm sure that Douglas would be on the side of the Palestinians if he was alive today.
All right. Go ahead, Carlos. Your closing.
I think that just like my brother right there, Leon and David, that we have to have solidarity. We have to have real allies, just like Dave said, that we can't have these fakes that are coming just to get their little power and try to subvert us. We really need people who are struggling, who will struggle with us and help us bring our quest for human rights, for democracy, for a living wage, for housing for people, just as Dr. Martin Luther King realized when Stanley Levinson and Miriam Wright Edelman gave him that idea, gave him the very idea and taught him of the Poor People's March. We need allies. We were a rainbow of nations. One of the logos of the Poor People's Campaign was indigenous, blacks, Puerto Ricans, and Appalachian whites. We need allies and our allies that were there to support us. And I think that more than anything is that we need to come together. We can't be negative like these slave master mentality where they are basically a replica of Hitler. I support everybody's solidarity, but they also have to support us too. And that's what I believe. We have to have the red, the indigenous people here that are struggling also. We have to have everybody here who is struggling. Like Leon says, it's not just a thing. We need allies. We really need allies more than anything else. Just like we saw in the demonstration, just like I saw yesterday in Washington, D.C. for the Freedom Ride, a rally that they had in the mall in Washington, D.C. We went, me and Angel. And we need that more than anything else.
Okay.
Without that, we'll never get nowhere.
Okay.
But we have to be visual. That's the only thing I can share.
Okay, that's good. And I just want to say one thing, that based on the topic that we were discussing tonight, you know, from 4th of July to Juneteenth, and then one of the final questions that we really didn't get into, but we did talk about a lot, says, do you think this Republic founding history should be rewritten based on information we know now? And I think we all agree that there should be some rewriting of history based on the myths of the fight for freedom in this country and independence. So there should be some rewriting
Could
of
we
that,
have that
history.
The next time?
That history.
We have that. Could we have that? Could we talk about that the next
time? Sure, sure. We can talk about it. I want to thank y'all for coming on. And I think Angel, he had to go because he left.
Yeah, he did. He had to
right.
go.
And I want to thank Dave Walker, Leon Van Dyke, Carlos Duffer, Angel Martinez for their part in the discussion. And a lot of information came out, y'all, tonight. And Dave, I mean, you was up tonight, man. You didn't leave us. Stay with us. Right. And everything.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Leon gave a presentation up. Leon, you still here?
Yeah.
Tell him you gave that presentation up at, what was that place?
Martha Vineyard.
Oh, wow, boy. You had
on the Juneteenth.
Good.
Okay. All right. I want to thank y'all. I know it's hot. You know, you got to
get everybody, and thank you.
But it was a good discussion.
Made my day.
That was the final segment of this month's The Struggle Continues Roundtable. That conversation was from the 4th of July to Juneteenth, What Do They Mean to Black People? Find all 8 segments on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Sanctuary intern Lizzie Kramer interviews Albany Center Gallery director Tony Iadicio about the creation of Albany's mural program, the significance of public art, and how art starts within a community.
My name is Lizzie Kramer. I'm an intern with the Sanctuary this summer looking at community-engaged art. I'm here with Tony Iadicio at the Albany Center Gallery to talk about public art in Albany.
My name is Tony Iadicio, Executive Director of Albany Center Gallery and Curator for our Capitol Walls mural program.
How did you get interested in that part of art?
The gallery, Albany Center Gallery, Albany Barn, and the Albany Parking Authority about 6 years ago got together. They were looking to add artwork into their spaces that they have for parking garages. So that kind of is how it started, where it was just these blank concrete spaces that people have to interact with. They see, they drive by them, they walk by them. And they helped fund and start a lot of the murals that we did in downtown Albany specifically. And really just by being an artist myself, working with many artists and seeing kind of inspiration from other cities and other places, that art really does have a way of sharing the people's stories and really just trying to put that on larger than life in public places was kind of an exciting thing, because not everyone feels comfortable going into gallery spaces or museums, but artwork is actually in the community. So we are very thoughtful and mindful of what actually is being depicted and who the people are that are creating it and kind of the reason why. And for us, whenever there's an open space, really it should be for the people. So a lot of the projects, whether they're murals or youth projects, we try to make sure that it's reflective of the community that it's serving and working with people from those communities.
How do these arts sort of interact with the community, play in community relationships?
So it actually starts there for us. Like, art should be accessible for everyone to either create or to enjoy it or just to be able to experience it. So when we do projects, usually partners in different communities reach out to us to collaborate on things. So we're a small staff, and most organizations that do the work that's going on are also small staff as well, or volunteer organizations. So kind of that many hands light work is when we come together to create projects. It's, you know, what do kids in the community want to create? Are there opportunities for them to create? Making sure that it's free for them and transportation is there, and just kind of taking away any boundaries or limitations that might be there, just so that way they can focus on being in a safe space to create and really open up their eyes to, you know, possibilities of things that they either experienced or things that they want to see different in the city, the state, the world.
And how do you connect with those communities?
So we connect word of mouth conversations, artists and community members recommending us to spaces and vice versa. And us also being intentional about who it is that we're working with. So really it's just a mindful effort of when we do partnerships or projects, making sure that those visions and the reason we're doing it is for the youth and for the community and for the art. And making sure that that's kind of the message through the whole project. that way things don't get kind of off track by going into different places. It really has a focus of what we're trying to create.
And what are some of the messages or things you've seen communities wanting to communicate with public artwork?
I think a lot of messages are about individuals sharing stories and perspectives and experiences, and especially for like the large murals that we've been doing. Each artist shares their story. And for us, say we've done 18 murals with 14 different artists, there's hundreds of other stories that should be told. So the goal is to actively try to find other opportunities, whether it's in public spaces or in the gallery space or on movable murals, for each artist to just share who they are, whether it's, you know, past traumas or past successes or things that are on their minds now. And with the way of the world, really just people talking and wanting to create change and trying to make a difference. I think that is kind of a key component of the artwork, is that I think people want to try to create change, and for them their art is their way of healing, but also a tool to help activate that.
How art can be used as sort of an action tool there. I'm curious what you've sort of observed or seen of that.
Just recently, an experience where someone shared experience of they're walking down the street with their young daughter. This is a Black family, and they saw a painting of a Black person on the side of the building that artist Jade Warwick created. And that girl turned to her father and said, "Look, Dad, it's like me." So that moment of a kid being able to see and reflect and see themselves in a picture that's being created, I think was important for the father to share. But I think also an awesome way for the artist to make sure that there's representation and that people are able to see themselves in these pieces of artwork. And it's not just sculptures and pieces of, you know, monuments of white men on horses throughout the cities or throughout the country. They're actually seeing people that look like them in our murals, which I think is super important.
When art takes on the public stage, does it have a different function, or how that sort of changes its dynamic?
Yeah, for me, again, my work that I paint is just kind of more calming and soothing. Mm-hmm. I think the artists that we work with that are doing murals and public artwork, their works are speaking louder volumes and really having a lot to say and a lot to express. And I think for mine, my own personal, I just like to create something in the evening time to where I can just unwind. The murals that we're creating are there 24/7, so people are seeing these and they're on display longer than just the time that the artist is creating. So I think that has a longer impact, because as we start to do more programs and projects, we really get to see kind of the wide variety and range of community members sharing, again, their experiences and their stories. And it really just, I think, makes Albany a special place, because it really does add uniqueness to the residents and community that live here. And really everyone can appreciate it, whether they walk by it, they drive by it, if they live in the neighborhood, or if they're visiting, you know, from out of town. It really just gives kind of a flavor of what this region and what Albany is about.
I'm curious, you've sort of mentioned the different projects, but a little bit more in depth about what movable murals is. Sure. And what Capitol walls are.
Awesome. Yeah, so the movable murals are usually done on plywood. Mm-hmm. And their plywood is 4x8 sheets. And we do exterior weather resistance, so that way we can put them out into the community. But it's a little bit easier way for people to get into creating artwork to where some people don't feel comfortable going 40 feet in the air. Mm. So the movable murals is kind of almost like an incubator to get artists ready for the next step, because you get to learn a lot through the process, scaling up your work from maybe a 2-inch design to 8 feet or up to 80 feet. Mm-hmm. The Capitol walls itself, again, is kind of more of an official program with partners that we have. So we work with different entities to help support those initiatives. And really it's a teamwork, because we work on the insurance for the artists, the lifts for the artists, the paints for the artists, kind of all of the logistics. And a lot of artists that we work with, we were fortunate enough to be one of their first projects or mural projects that they've done. So it's really just trying to create a space where they can learn while they're doing it. And then from there, they're able to do this in other cities or throughout, you know, the country or the world if they wish to. So really just trying to create kind of a package of like the skill sets that are needed, because you learn while you're doing that type of work, whether it's the wind, you know, being up there and it's 30 miles an hour, it's not safe. So you have to be down lower to the ground or even off the lift. The paints that you're using, making sure that the colors you're using are appropriate. The way the sun hits the wall, kind of like all of those elements are what goes into actually doing the piece of artwork. And we want to try to make sure that it lasts. And our goal is, if these can last 15 to 20 years, that would be awesome. But some murals don't last that long. So trying to make sure that who's the next artist that will be able to use that space and then share their story. And with times that change, each artist will kind of be able to share different perspectives. And I think that's pretty exciting.
And how have you seen different artists like react to having that different surface and that much larger canvas?
I think a lot of artists, just in conversations, some don't believe it's even a possibility. So I think kind of the cool thing is like that it is possible and that people are actively working to try to make more of it. So I think that a lot of artists are just excited to create something that they can give back to their community. And really just learning and kind of being on the job training and really just doing it. And there's artists that, you know, can jump right in and within an hour they have it, you know, they're totally comfortable. So it's just really just empowering and making sure people have the resources and kind of the tools that are necessary for that, and then they just kind of create their magic. So it's all of them that do the work, really.
There's any like favorite or any murals that have particularly stood out to you over the years?
I think for the Capitol walls, the murals, that's all of them stand out, truthfully, just because each artist I got to create a relationship with and have conversations, and just seeing kind of pushing through, you know, when it's super hot out on days when it's like 105 degrees and they're still working hard and trying to have their vision come to life. It's really kind of those experiences that show that the resilience and kind of the passion and love people put into the creation, that they kind of go above and beyond. So I think each one is my favorite, truthfully. So maybe I'm biased, but the humans that are creating them are very special. And our goal is to just have more artists kind of help shape the community and shape the city, because I think that a lot of creative people have awesome things to say and work to do.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Lizzie Kramer interviewing Albany Center Gallery director Tony Iadicio about the Albany's mural program. That concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Basila-Hickey.
I am Eileen Javier, and our engineer is Sina Basila-Hickey. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider joining us in our summer sustainer campaign and give a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer. Your contribution will help us reach our July goal. Sign up at mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday, 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all of today's stories at mediasanctuary.org/stories, through a Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.